Thank you for listening to Lakeshore Public Radio at 89.1 FM on the dial and streaming worldwide, including London, where our guest will be calling in at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Getting my stations confused here. Coming up in just a little bit, we are going to meet a young man by the name of Giuseppe Filato, who has been writing some interesting books, to say the least. We'll talk to him about his appearance here in Northwest Indiana on Friday, October 4th. We'll talk about his career and a little bit about some of the books he's written. All of that coming up in just a bit. After your headlines here. Good afternoon. You are listening to Lakeshore Public Radio at 89.1 FM on the dial and streaming at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm Tom Lounges. It's time for Midwest Beat, and this program is all about the arts. It could be music, film, books. Well, we've kind of got a little of all of that today. We're going to be talking with Giuseppe Filato. He is an author of many books. Some are, well, they're all based in science and science fiction, but some have elements of intrigue and truth and conversation starting. Interesting topics, to say the least. And we're going to get to know the author. We're going to talk to Dane Cook, who's bringing him to Northwest Indiana. In fact, he'll be flying in from London on Friday, October 4th, to Hobart, Indiana, to meet fans and readers. We're going to talk with Dane in just a moment here. But first, let's set the mood a little bit, as we like to do, with some music about us, us, and them. It's Pink Floyd. Dane Cook joining us momentarily. Us and them. It's Pink Floyd. Great song selection there by my in-studio guest, Dane Cook. Dane, it was a great suggestion to open the show with.
Well, you're welcome.
I really enjoyed that. Haven't played Pink Floyd in a while, but it seems to fit. We're going to be talking in a few moments with Giuseppe Filato, and he has written books about them.
The other side of the moon.
The other side of the moon. The other side of Mars, perhaps. We'll get a little out there in space and other topics as we get to know this gifted writer. who's calling in from London. In just a moment, we'll have him on the show. But Dane, I got to know Giuseppe Filato through you. You stopped in over at the record store and says, hey, this author is got lots to offer, and I'd like to bring him to town and pick up the story there. You're a fan. How did you become a fan, first of all, of Giuseppe Filato, and why are you bringing him to meet folks?
I'm a fan of the Big Bear Owen Benjamin. He's doing a show right next door at the Art Theater. And Giuseppe Filato, also known as the Kurgan, also does YouTube videos. And I listened to a few and got sold. And I just asked him one day, hey, you want to come meet Owen Benjamin? I'll fly you down here. I don't know how we'll do it, but you want to do that?
And he's well, you're like, flying him in from England.
Yeah, from okay. England. Yeah, and he's like, he said, yeah, but he didn't think I was really serious. And I got the flights, the GoFundMe page, and I said, all right, here's your dates. And he's like, he came right aboard, and he's excited about it. And we've got to know each other a little bit in the meantime. But I started a GoFundMe page all on faith, and I'm about 80%. Recouped, and I'm through a couple of his books, and he's a fascinating guy, and hopefully some people can come out and say hello to him.
Now, he's going to be in town at the Record Bin at 218 Main Street in Hobart on Friday, October 4th, and he'll be in the back room there meeting and greeting folks and doing a little speaking from 2 to 5 p.m. So he's got like a three-hour window there. Now, if anyone is interested in attending this, you can get a hold of Dane Cook directly by calling 815-761-0854. That's 815-761-0854. If today's show intrigues you a little bit, if you're not familiar with Giuseppe's work, maybe you should come out and say hello and meet the man himself. And I just think that this is a pretty fascinating event, just because of the fact that here you are, a fan that is so moved by things that you are putting your money out there, walking the walk and talking the talk, and bringing this author to a new country here to meet his fans.
Well, I had problems. I'm a truth seeker, and the internet's great, but there's nothing happening. Nobody's touching and shaking hands and looking each other's eyes. Mm-hmm. I want to do that. I want to meet Owen Benjamin. I want to shake his hand. I want to meet Giuseppe Filato. I want to shake his hand. I want to bring people together, communicate on the internet, but we're losing our human touch.
I agree.
And I want to touch and feel and smell you, and I want to size you up. And $2,500 action, it's paying off. And it will pay off, because it always does pay off.
Now, what's your game plan as the producer of this event? Are we going to be doing, is he going to be doing a book signing? Is he going to be doing a speaking, Q&A?
So we're bringing 15 books. None of them are signed, because it seemed like we were getting good feedback. You know, we have 22 seats. I have one sold. Owen Benjamin's going to have 400 some people next door, and all of those fans are excited about it. So we don't. It all depends. We're kind of winging it here, but we're going to sign any books people bring if people want books. If we're asking for $75, you'll get a signed book and a seat. I'm going to walk around with cards outside and invite folks in, and just kind of winging it here.
Okay. And they can get a hold of you through the phone number, or they can email you directly. Jesus, can't breathe here. Email you directly at dcook056@gmail.com. And again, we'll give the number and the email out again a little later in the show if you want to write it down. But we started off with us and them, and now it's time for us and him. And that is, of course, Giuseppe joining us long distance from London, calling in today to talk with Dane and I. Giuseppe, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
We made it. You got off the train, you got to the phone, and here we are.
Yes, under the usual British rain, but here I am. A bit wet, but alive.
And you know what? It's pouring rain here as well, so we are kindred spirits in the depressed weather situation here.
Excellent.
Now, first of all, I want to introduce you to my listeners as far as your career. You are not only an author, but you're a hypnotist. You're a master martial artist. You have a very interesting life. Born in Venice, as I understand, raised in South Africa, living in London, quite the world traveler, quite the man about town. Tell us a little bit about your history, Giuseppe.
Well, I don't know. How many hours have you got? I'm going to try and keep it sort of the thumbnail biography. But, you know, I think basically crazy people are in my DNA because as far back as I can find, we've got documented evidence that my family came over from what effectively is either Albania or Greece now. And the legend goes that we were the survivors of Troy, who eventually went on to found Venice. Hmm. But for about 800 years, we can track back what my people did. And they basically came over to Italy, had a huge fight in the south of the region, where they took over a tower that, you know, that region had been in a fight for about 200 years. And basically, they beat everybody up, took over this tower. And from that day, they had a noble title, which my branch of the family kind of lost because we're even crazier than the other guys. And we went further north and settled essentially in Venice, which is where my grandfather was from. I was actually born in Turin, which is on the other side of Turin. But, you know, the wanderlust and explorer sort of genetics are pretty strong because when I was about 4 years old, my father went to Nigeria and we went with him. And we sort of grew up in Nigeria, a little bit of Italy, then it was Botswana, then South Africa, with a bit of England in between. And then I came on holiday in the UK about 15 years ago, and my first ex-wife at the time said, oh, this is nice, we should move here. So we did after 3 days. And I've been here ever since, more or less.
Now, it's interesting because you are also a second-generation author. Which I didn't realize, your father had written the book that we used in the flyer here on Africa, Life and Death in Africa. So is this something that he handed down to you as far as the interest in writing? When did you gravitate towards being a writer?
Oh, no. It went the other way around, actually. I wrote my book, The Face on Mars, first in 95. And then he wrote his, I think it was in about 2010 or 2011, something like that. No, the writing actually came about as a love-hate relationship. I'm a pretty instinctive person, and, you know, I like to read a lot. I've always read since I was a kid. I've read literally thousands of books. And when I'd have a conversation with somebody, you know, to try and explain some of my ideas, I realized that, you know, my brain maybe works a bit different or a bit quicker or a bit stranger. And so I thought writing things down made it easier to communicate with other human beings. And it was also a better way to sort of get my message across, whatever I wanted to say, because, you know, it's just easier. You get a bit more time to explain things the way you want rather than get sidetracked, which I have a large tendency to do, as you've probably noticed.
What is your thought on coming here to Hobart, Indiana? I saw your blog where you were like, I can't believe this fan reached out. Now I'm going. I got the ticket. You seemed a little bit surprised that that Dane was willing to do what he's done and to bring you here. And what are your expectations?
Well, the thing about Dane that surprised me a little bit is that I think we are kindred spirits because, you know, I think in your introduction he mentioned that, you know, I didn't think he was serious. Mm-hmm. That's not really the case. I did think he was serious. I just didn't expect him to set up a GoFundMe page and buy me the tickets within 6 hours of asking me, you want to come over? So I thought, okay, you know, you're willing to go the whole hog. I have to do it too.
Wow. 6 hours, Dane. That was pretty quick. Are you impulsive or?
Yeah, I have a tendency. Yeah. Okay. It's just when I know what I want, I go and get it. You know, sometimes I fail.
And you're happy with the results so far, right? You're
absolutely
getting great
I'm
response.
Blown away by the expectations. The financial you know, cost is this is going to pay back dividends for the rest of my life. I could care less about how much it costs.
Mm-hmm. So have you come to the States before to promote your books, Giuseppe?
I did, actually. In 2006, shortly after I wrote The Face on Mars, I was invited to Minneapolis, St. Paul by a then TV producer. And I was interviewed on American television for two shows. Unfortunately, I can't actually remember the title of the thing because this was, you know, 25 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was interesting. And I like the States. I mean, I like the American people. I find them very friendly, generally easy to get along with. And so I visited also my my brother, which at the time was in California, and a friend, which I had in Arizona. So I saw a little bit of the States. And then I was there again in 2004 in Palm Springs for a holiday.
Okay.
And I haven't really been back since. So it's been a while.
How long will you be staying on this trip? I know you're going to be here for the one day in Northwest Indiana. Are you going to be staying since you're here for a while? Or?
Oh, no, it's literally just a couple of days. I'm flying back early Sunday morning. So, you know, I'll be there, I think it's the Friday and the Saturday, pretty much the full day. And then I think that's pretty much it.
Dane, this was for you. What is the correlation between the comedian and the author that you thought this was a good pairing here?
The Owen Benjamin is a kind of a truth seeker Christian who just spits out strong realities, and he attracts strong male role models. So I was attracted to him, and Giuseppe, you know, is called the Kurgan on the internet by contemporaries of his, and I heard that, and something was mentioned of him, and I'm curious about everything. I went and checked him out, listened to a few videos, and I literally converted to Catholicism within the week before that.
Really?
Yeah. I was raised Catholic, but I found out that I was actually raised in the Novus Ordo church, and he bridged that gap for me. The way he spoke, the logic he provided about it, bridged that gap for me. And that was all I had been searching for, that for a very long time.
Okay. So, Giuseppe, have you ever met Owen Benjamin before? Are you a fan? Are you familiar with his work?
No, I never met him at all. I interacted very, very little with him online, in the sense that I made a couple of comments on one of his live streams and he read them. And I sent him a book as well, which he, you know, he opens his mail online sometimes, and that's about the extent of it. I liked him because, I didn't know anything about Owen Benjamin. I had no idea who he was, his whole story or anything. But I as you do on the internet, I got there somehow by some link from somewhere. And what I was impressed by was the fact that he is very open with his life and what's going on. And, you know, when he makes a mistake, he quite readily admits it without dodging, you know. Mm-hmm. So he'd made some bad calls on some people that he trusted or whatever, and he just admitted, outright admitted, and he said, you know, I thought you guys were wrong when you were warning me about it, but actually you were right and I was wrong. And, you know, we all make mistakes. We are all human beings. We're all, you know, broken and fallen. But it's a rare person that is so readily willing to admit when he's wrong, and it's demonstrated to him. You know, we're all wrong about a massive number of things, but
right.
Few of us, you know, just accept that and move on once it's shown to us.
Yeah, there's nobody perfect.
No. Well, there was one guy, but they nailed him to a cross.
That's true. Yeah, he's not here any longer. Did it surprise you to find out that Dane converted back to Catholicism after getting to know your work?
Well, I need to give you a little bit of background on that.
Okay.
Because the answer is both yes and no. So I was a complete heathen, living completely outside of any kind of Christianity or anything else until, officially until 2017, because that's when I got baptized. But certainly for at least, you know, a good 45, 46 years of my life, I used to think you'd have to be, you know, really not very intelligent to be a Christian, let's put it that way.
Okay.
And then I had my Road to Damascus moment, which is, you know, probably not very useful to try and talk about to your listeners because it's a very subjective experience. But that absolutely convinced me that there was a God and God was love. And then I spent a few years trying to figure out, you know, which God and what kind of God and what are the rules.
Right.
So eventually I settled on the fact that Christianity was real. And then, well, then which Christianity? And in that research, I discovered that the Catholic Church seemed to have most of the answers. You know, it was either going to be the Catholics or the Orthodox because they were there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But what I discovered about the Catholics is that when Vatican II happened, the whole church had basically been taken over by people that were the opposite of Christians. And they completely confused the waters intentionally and so on. I'm probably offending every listener you have, by the way, so stop me when, you know, you're...
Okay.
Little lights go off or whatever, but
well, I understand. I understand the whole Vatican II change. It went from the Latin masses and the old teachings to suddenly becoming more of a business, and everything was in English. And I know a lot of the old school Catholics really didn't care for that. Of course, that's been the norm now for many, many years. So what you're saying is you embrace the old school Catholicism.
Absolutely. And
okay.
The people that I was baptized with are not in communion with Rome, because as far as we're concerned, Rome is filled with people that are working for the enemy, if anything. And then as a result of that, not too long ago, a few months back, I finally wrote a little book which sort of expounded a little bit my experiences and the research that I've done in a very, you know, pretty simplistic and very crude and direct manner, because I use quite a bit of rhetoric as well as dialectic in presenting my case. So I was hoping that that would have a bit of an impact, but I wasn't quite prepared for, you know, Dane is not the only person that converted to Catholicism as a result of reading that book. And I'm sort of keeping a little list of people when they email me and tell me that, because mm-hmm. I'm quite surprised, happily so, of course, but... So, yeah, that was how that came about, I think.
And the book you're speaking of is titled Believe, correct?
Yes, it's titled Believe, and it has a long subtitle, which I don't actually remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, it's quite, a very direct subtitle. Because I wrote it for, you know, people who were like myself, completely outside the church. So.
Okay, yeah, very good.
I think, you know, I've actually got a copy here. I just picked it up. So if you want, I can read the tagline.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
So it's called Believe, Real Christianity Taking Christendom Back, and then it's got a sub-tagline, because I like complicated things. And it says, a reply to the pederast-infested Vatican, the churches of all denominations, and a manual for atheists, agnostics, and would-be pagans. So it's a bit of a mouthful.
It is, but it kind of sums up what the book is inside. You're selling what you're selling. I mean, it is your thoughts, and you're putting it right out there. It's like, well, here's the Cliff Notes version. If you want more, open the cover.
I've got a brilliant review from, it's actually on the back of the book, because it's a guy I know from online. He's also a writer. He wrote, he's a Hugo-nominated author of a blog series called Safe Space as Rape Room, which was a series of posts on essentially child abuse within the science fiction community. And he read the book and he gave me an awesome little review, which says, you know, it was quite long, but the last line is, in Belief, Filotto exemplifies a unique and sorely needed class of character that has as yet eluded the catalog of role-playing games everywhere, the theologian berserker.
Berserker, I love that.
That is awesome. Yeah.
Of course, the one of the books you had mentioned earlier is The Face on Mars, and we're going to get to talking about that in just a moment. But let's take a slight moment, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. This is David Bowie.
To the girl with the mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no. Daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Take a look at the low man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars? On America's tortured brow, that Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog, and clowns. But the film is a sad thing for, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be written again, as I ask you to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's a freaky show. Take a look at the lawman, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
Is there life on Mars? David Bowie wondered. Many of us do. We're still exploring the Angry Red Planet, as it's called. But one gentleman has written about it a number of years ago. He found a face on Mars through NASA's wonderful cameras and satellites. And that man is Giuseppe Filato. He is our guest today. And let's switch gears from Catholicism to extraterrestrial life. Giuseppe, what's with the fascination of Mars, and what prompted you to write the book, The Face on Mars, which is probably the one that got you the most recognition thus far?
Well, I've always been interested in astronomy since I was a little kid. I was very lucky that I had an uncle that was sort of a scientific bent, and he'd gotten a telescope when I was in my teens, but even before that, he'd explained to me what a light year was and so on. So I was always fascinated by it, and when the Face on Mars pictures came out, which were discovered by a guy called Molinar and Di Pietro. They had scoured through all the images of the Viking images of Mars, and they found two images that were miscatalogued. And when they looked at them, it looked like there was a giant face on the planet. Now, when this came out, it was sort of early 90s, and it was quite a big thing online and pretty much everywhere. The official story from NASA was, oh, no, it's just a bunch of rocks. And, you know, there was a few scientists that were saying, no, it's not just a bunch of rocks. This deserves to be looked at better. So I started to write a science fiction book, to be honest with you. I just thought, nah, it's a bunch of rocks. But it sort of looked like a face, and I'm going to write a story about what it would be like if it actually turns out to be real.
Okay.
Well, for me, science fiction is a lot of science, a little bit of fiction. So I did quite a bit of research. And in doing that research, I concluded that it was artificial. And I think I'm actually the first person who has figured out what probably happened on Mars. It's since been copied by a couple of other authors and so on. But I was actually the first one that sort of came up with a theory that sort of made sense. Because I do think there used to be humanoid type people living on Mars, and I think we're probably somewhat related to them. I know that sounds very crazy, but there's a lot of science behind what I came up with in that.
Well, not really, because I've read over the years, I'm fascinated, and sometimes you got to wonder, why do we think we're so pompous that we are the only intelligent creatures in the universe? But you look back at history, you look back at some of the great wonders of the world and the time frame that some of these were built, the Great Wall, the pyramids, things like that, and the technology really was hard to imagine at that time. So maybe there was some kind of help from above to template it, blueprint it. Your thoughts run along that lines? I've read a few school of thoughts like that.
Absolutely. I mean, the pyramids in Egypt, the Great Pyramid in particular, we can't build that today. I've worked as I studied civil engineering and I've worked in construction since I was 16. And I do not know of a single civil engineer that, has actually looked at the Great Pyramid that says, yeah, we can build that now. We actually can't. The tolerances in it, just to find the site where to build it so that it stays within level. The Great Pyramid is still the heaviest building in the world, and it's out of level by less than half an inch after millennia.
Wow.
And I can tell you right now that, for example, I worked briefly for a company that was doing some of the interiors inside the Shard, quite a famous building here in London. And the company that I was working for had nothing to do with the structural building, just to be clear. But the structural members of the Shard are out of position, in some cases, by up to a foot. Now, the Great Pyramid is out of level by less than half an inch, and the casing stones, you can't put a business card between them. And these things are on average 2.5 tons. They're not bricks that you can tap into place.
Mm-hmm.
I could literally go on for an hour just telling you details of the construction that we can't repeat now. But perhaps an even more important point is that the units of measure that the Egyptians use are more accurate than the meter. Originally the meter was conceived as, I can't remember if it's 1 millionth or the 10th millionth part of a line taken from the North Pole to the equator running on the surface of the Earth. That's not a precise measurement because the Earth's not a perfect sphere. Now, the royal cubit is the millionth or 10th millionth, I can't remember off the top of my head which one of those it is, part of a line taken from the North Pole to the center of the Earth, which is a pretty precise measurement and has been measured by, now that we have satellites. So how did the Egyptians know to use that unit of measurement? And even more interesting is, I have to give credit to Robert Bouval, who came up with it originally, the idea that the three pyramids at Giza represent the belt of Orion. And if you do that, you find that indeed in Egypt there is quite a lot of resemblance from sort of what they built on the ground to what is in the sky.
Hmm.
Even more interesting, that they had a lot of these big sort of monoliths, these stones, obelisks that they used, that actually marked distances in a way that we still haven't done today. And the units of measure that they used are representative of the size of the Earth. So they are a fraction of the size of the Earth, which is sort of recursive in the way that you can measure, things like the radius of the Earth or the circumference and so on. And it's also the Great Pyramid is located in the precise center of all the land mass on the planet, which again, how would you be able to do that unless mm-hmm. you serve, it's an incredible building.
So it's actually built on a platform that has not shifted at all with the different plates of the Earth?
That's right. It's built on a solid bedrock, which, again, the Great Pyramid is about 230 meters on a side, so it's a huge building. To just find a location that has that sort of, underlying rock strata of such, depth and magnitude that it pretty much doesn't move for millennia, that alone, just finding that now, that would cost millions, because you would have to do a number of boreholes, you'd have to study the geology over a large, large area to be able to be sure that it's the right thing.
You'd have to have underground radar, things like that. I mean, they'd had none of that back then.
Well, you see, the thing is, I think that there was a technology that was I would say different, somewhat parallel or either above or different than what we have now.
Okay.
A very interesting idea is that actually the pyramids at Giza were weapons. And the guy who wrote about that is called Joseph Farrell. And it sounds a little bit strange if you're not familiar with, shall we say, a slightly esoteric part of physics, but it makes perfect sense. And what convinced me is is the work by another man called Christopher Dunn, who wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant, where he explains how, in his opinion, the Great Pyramid was actually a kind of a power station. And this guy's an engineer. And, you know, he talks about the tooling marks on the blocks of stone and how these things, we can't do them now. The best drill that you've got, the best diamond tip drill that we have, does not core granite out at the speed at which you can see in the tooling marks on the stones inside the Great Pyramid. And I've been inside it, and I absolutely agree with him. You know, he's absolutely right about that. So the technology is a little bit different, and, you know, probably we don't quite understand it as much as we would think we do.
Is the train of thought then that the science behind the pyramids is also the same science that was used on Mars, and that perhaps in the future, as we get closer and are able to explore better, we're going to find a parallel? Is that the train of thought that we're having between these authors and yourself?
Well, I think my train of thought is different from everybody else's, although Graham Hancock did plagiarize part of my book, although he apologized and, you know, admitted it, so it's fine. But my train of thought is simply that I think the solar system was inhabited or maybe even seeded, you know, a long time ago with different types of humans, because we definitely had Neanderthal man here. You know, we had different types of humans on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And although no one can date with precision when Mars had flowing water and so on, it was obviously a long time ago. I believe that Mars was destroyed intelligently, and there's geological evidence of that all over the planet. To say that, and we also have what I think are two leftover bullets still spinning around the planet, which is Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars. And I think it was destroyed by using asteroids as weapons, which would make an atom bomb look like a spitball, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there might have been another planet between Mars and Jupiter, which was totally destroyed, and which is now our asteroid belt. Mars had some continuation of that war. And I think that the survivors of that war, possibly from both sides, ended up on Earth and are, generally speaking, considered the gods of old. Because, you know, the Egyptian gods, the Germanic gods, the Aztec gods, they're actually all the same guys. They just have different names and different cultures, but they seem to have the same sort of properties and abilities and so on.
Okay. Now, Face of Mars originally came out, as you mentioned, in the mid-90s, I believe. You've recently done a revised and updated version just a few years ago. What is new in the revised version that you have since discovered and updated?
The Face of Mars is a pretty big book. It's about 500 pages, and it covers a lot of topics, generally with a pretty broad brush, but there's a huge amount of references. So what I was missing as a teach, I knew that you couldn't do what the Martians or whatever you want to call them were with the normal rocket technology. And there had to be sort of anti-gravity technology to do all this stuff, which I knew existed because there have been UFOs filmed by the space shuttle, which are, you know, you can still see those videos online. And they're definitely craft that move in a way that we cannot do, you know, that we, as far as most people are concerned, we can't do. I do believe that certainly the Americans have since rediscovered this anti-gravity technology. In fact, there's details on this, there's patent numbers of this technology in the book. But in essence, what I wasn't aware of, I thought that the anti-gravity machines had originally started with a guy called Thomas Townsend Brown, who had eventually given it to the U.S. Naval Research Laboratories in about 54. And, you know, after that, sort of, I thought the American military had pretty much developed it from then on.
Mm-hmm.
What I was not aware of was that actually Nazi Germany, towards the end of the Second World War, had developed some anti-gravity technology machines. And there's a very interesting idea there, because very shortly after the war, you had the Americans launched a secret sort of secret project called Project High Jump, which was headed by Admiral Byrd, whose documented diaries are still top secret, and who apparently died insane. But that man was definitely not insane. Mm-hmm. Very shortly after the Second World War ended, America sent a few thousand soldiers and warships to Antarctica, supposedly to do a geological survey. You know, this is right after the war. Money is not exactly growing on trees, and this is a huge expedition that was supposed to last months. They came back after a few weeks, and they'd lost men, they'd lost ships, the details of which are still not exactly known, they'd lost planes. And when Admiral Byrd was being interviewed by a journalist on the ship returning to America, a journalist from a newspaper called El Mercurio, and he admitted to this journalist that he said, we must prepare for craft that can do, flying craft that can do things we cannot do, of polar origin. Now, the mythology is that, you know, Hitler didn't die in the bunker and the Nazis had Antarctica bases and so on. There is not a huge amount of evidence to prove that one way or the other, but I think there's enough speculative evidence to, I think, prove the fact that probably the Nazis did have some kind of at least small base on Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Very shortly after that, you had the Roswell incident, which, you know, has been one of the mainstays of UFO enthusiasts. But original idea was, yes, it was an alien craft, but not aliens as in extraterrestrials, but aliens as in not Americans, as in Germans. So it's an interesting concept.
Face on Mars is based on, as you mentioned, started as science fiction, but based on a lot of fact at this point. You have also written sci-fi books and Overlords of Mars. Let's talk a little about that series. Did that come before or after Face of Mars?
No, much after. So The Face on Mars is not fiction at all. The Face on Mars is a completely factual scientific book. It doesn't have any fiction in it.
Okay.
Overlords of Mars is pure fiction, you know, it's science fiction. And I put a lot of the science and a lot of the speculation that I have worked out over the years in those books as though it were fact. Now, the interesting thing is that in the first book of the Overlords of Mars series, I did put passages that are absolutely factual. And at the back of the book, I tell you, you know, that when you're reading sort of italized chapters, those are actually historical things that really happened. So I mix in quite a lot of factual history and certainly a lot of factual science to extrapolate a little bit what I think happened. Now, the interesting thing is I wrote the first book in 2011, and I did the update on The Face of Mars in 2014. And since those books have been out, some of the things that I had speculated a little bit wildly, admittedly, you know, I didn't really have a lot of evidence to support my theories. But since then, some of those things have become more and more likely to actually be correct. So it's mm-hmm. quite an interesting effect, let's say.
How many books are in the Overlord series?
Well, there are two of them that are out. The third book has, unfortunately, is about 30% written. But, you know, I've just got really busy. I had a son a few months back. I got married again.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you. So I've just had a very busy time, and I haven't quite got to it, but it is the intention to finish it. Hopefully next year I'll get to the third book, which will finish the trilogy, but there is a fourth book which I want to write as well. It's all in my head, but hopefully I'll get it on paper soon.
Do you see it becoming either a miniseries or a film? Have you shopped it at all? Has there been any interest on the film side to bring Overlords of Mars to fruition as far as the next level of medium?
I am absolutely useless at marketing. So I haven't even bothered to market the series at all, because my idea is let's finish it first and then I'll market it. But yes, I have that. It's been written. The first book is a bit of an introduction to a bunch of topics. The second book is certainly written with a more cinematic sort of effect in mind, and so will be the third and the fourth. So, yeah, the idea is there. I was approached when I wrote The Face on Mars 25 years ago by people that worked in the TV industry, and let's just say that didn't pan out because they I even found a backer for them that would finance it, but they literally couldn't put together a script within a month. So it was like I was a bit weirded out by that, because I can put a script together in about a week, you know. They're going to pay me for it. I'll probably do it in 3 days.
If you just tuned in, my guest is Giuseppe Filato. He is an author of both fact and fiction. And right now we are talking about Overlords of Mars, a series of books that he has created with the third on the way. Giuseppe, we are getting tight on time. I do want to touch on one other aspect of your career, and that is Sistema. You are, as we mentioned in the beginning, a martial artist, and as I understand, one of the best out there. Let's talk about Sistema. It's a discipline that I am not familiar with. I had studied Kenpo years ago as a young man, and I'm familiar with some of the more popular martial arts, but that is one I had not heard of until learning about you. What is Sistema?
Very few people have heard about Sistema, because I, just to give a very quick background, but I started doing karate when I was 3 years old because of my dad. So by the time I was, 26, 27, I'd done karate for 20 years, more or less, on and off. And then I met one of these Russian guys that, when I came to the UK, actually, I met one of them properly. I met one when I was working as a bodyguard in South Africa that I just thought, this guy is scary. And, I've trained martial arts all my life and I can't touch this guy. I'm just worried about, I don't know what he can do, but I know he can do stuff that I can't understand.
Okay.
Then I came to the United States and I met these, I started to train with this guy. And the first class I went to, I realized, the guy that was teaching, I literally could not put a hand on him. And I've been training for 25 years in a way that is probably not allowed in the Western Hemisphere without going to jail now, because, the rules in our dojo were like, if you bleed, you clean up your blood, and if you get knocked unconscious when you wake up, you carry on. So, in most countries in the West now, that would be
right,
not allowed. But and I couldn't touch this guy. I couldn't do anything to him. So I started training with them. And then after a few years, they told me, oh, you should teach now, which I thought was a bit weird, because I was like, I still don't know anything. But, compared to most of the other people, I suppose, I'd learned something. And, I haven't trained now for about 4 or 5 years, just again, because life gets in the way. And I'm 50 years old now. So, if something has to go that way, I'm probably not going to train. I'm just going to do what I need to do to get out of the bad situation. But it's a very interesting martial art. It was invented by the Soviets originally. And it uses, the main difference is that it uses the nervous system that you use to rest and digest. It uses that to fight instead of your normal nervous system, which most people use to fight. And the beauty of that is that your unconscious, let's say, your automatic nervous system has got a far higher processing power than your conscious brain, let's say. So even if you only get a tiny percentage of your unconscious mind to operate properly, it will, you'll be able to do things that seem like science fiction. And, if I hadn't had some of these guys do some of these things on me, and I felt it very much, I would have thought, that was nonsense. But, it works. It's a very interesting.
So it's more instinctual than conscious.
Well, yes, the drills, 90% of the drills in Sistema are generally to try and keep your nervous system calm while some really scary, weird, painful things are going on. And the thing is, the more you manage to do that, it's almost like time slows down. I remember once there was some people that came to watch the class, and I was sparring with one of my friends. And the class before us was a spinning class, so unfortunately there was pools of, sweat and water and whatever on the floor. And as I was stepping back, I completely slipped. I mean, I was, heads over heels in the air, busy falling down. And my friend that I was sparring with was very good as well. Immediately, as soon as he saw that I was falling, he rushed in to finish me off. But as I was falling, I saw that where his foot was, and with my foot, I just gently pushed on his ankle so as not to break it, because, if you kick it, and he fell over, and so he fell over, and I rolled on top, and I punched him, and that was it. I kind of won the fight. The guys watching were like, how did you do that? That looked like you were dead, and then you kind of made him fall while you were falling. How did you even do that? But for me, it was like slow motion. And that's kind of what happens when you get used to treating intense situations, they become normal for you, then it isn't so scary, you know. You've got more time to act.
Now, Sistema, the book has been out for how long? And I understand there's videos that go with it. If you get the book, you got access to watch certain videos.
Yeah, there's 40 or 41 videos, I don't remember, that you get access to online. And yeah, the book's been out since 2011, and it's done very well. I must say, I still get emails, you know, it's been out now for 8 years, and it's still one of the best sellers in that field, really.
Are you seeing a rise in popularity with Sistema versus the more traditional martial arts?
Yes and no. Now, the thing about Sistema is when you look at the videos, it looks absolutely fake. I'm the first person to tell you that if you look at Sistema videos, it just looks, I mean, one of the top instructors looks like the Michelin man. And, you know, he kind of looks like he's just rolling people off his belly, and it looks absolutely absurd. The thing is, people don't know what they're watching. Most of the drills, like I said, are not like, you know, you sparring heavily, but they're trying to develop a level of sensitivity about direction, motion, movement, structure, and so on. So some of these things look absurd. I mean, there used to be, I haven't found it now for a while, there used to be a video of me being literally thrown around like a rag doll by this Russian guy. And the people that know me thought, oh my God, you must have been black and blue, because they know that I wouldn't fake it, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it, even myself looking at it, it just looks like I'm totally complying with everything he does. And it's not that at all. That's the only way I can fall without breaking my neck, you know. So it's a very interesting process, let's say.
What's next for you, Giuseppe? You are going to finish the Overlords of Mars trilogy, hopefully a fourth book on the way. What other than that, what is on your agenda? What's on your to-do list, your bucket list?
Well, my bucket list would be to go to Mars, but, you know, I think I need to get Elon Musk on side or something.
Go find me. Send a Kurgan to Mars.
There we go. There's your marketing guy right there. Dane's going to send you to Mars by getting his GoFundMe going.
Honestly, Dane is awesome. He's just, I don't know, he doesn't have a stop button, which I understand, but you know, in a different field from me, I guess.
So, when you get here to Hobart, what do you expect to speak about? A little bit of everything that we've discussed? Are you going to talk about Catholicism, Sistema, Mars? Is there a certain platform that you're looking to speak on at this point?
Not really. I mean, I've got a talk that I gave originally, you know, 20 years ago on the face on Mars. Just to tell you how long ago it was, I've got transparencies, you know, when you used to show slides. Yeah, and so that's what I've got with me. I'll take that along just in case, you know, probably there's no such thing as a transparency light anymore, but people can look at it.
One of those overhead projectors?
Yeah,
I might be able to get my hands on one. I'll have to look and see. If I can get it, I'll pull it in. And we can have it for that event.
Oh, that would be awesome. That'd be great. But I'm pretty free form, you know, whatever people want to throw at me. And also, if it's 3 hours, we have a good time. You know, again, depending, you know, if there's 200 people lining up outside, maybe you want to just do like a half hour per group. But if there's only 20 people or whatever, we can talk about whatever they want. And I'll try and make it as slightly democratic in that I'll ask the room what they want to hear most and carry on with that.
Okay. Any final thoughts, Dane or Giuseppe, on our topic today?
I just wanted to thank you for having me on air. And thank you to Dane for making everything happen. Dane is awesome. Another thing he hasn't told you is that he's found a proper Catholic church, and he's already getting people to come to Latin Mass. The guy is just, I don't know, he's, like I said, he doesn't have a stop button, but in a good way. And very impressive.
I would love to be able to hear an old school Latin Mass. I haven't heard one in years.
Learned the Hail Mary in Latin, it's about the only thing I could say to you, but there's a reverence to it that you have to experience by going there.
There's a magical tone to the Latin language. When you hear it, it can't help but seem to boost you. It's magical.
It's a dead language, so it can't be changed. And that's the vehicle that they use to subvert people, to change the history, is by using their language against them. And you can't do that with Latin, because it's been there since the beginning. And it just ties all the way to the beginning.
There's a beauty to it, though.
It's
you
a
listen to
yes,
a Latin
absolutely.
Mass, there's a beauty to it.
There is.
So, okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. We look forward to seeing you, Giuseppe, when you join us here on Friday, October 4th. Is that? That's next week.
Yeah, I got the GoFundMe. I'm almost there. www.gofundme.com/thekurganmeetsthebears. I got a little bit more to cover, but otherwise, we're set to go.
That sounds like a book title right there. The Kurgan Meets the Bears.
Yeah, it does.
I like that. All right. Also, keep up with Giuseppe at gfilotto.com. That's gfilotto.com. You'll find out all the books and all the information about him. And you do have blogs there too, correct?
He does. Okay. It's fascinating. He's got tons of stuff on there. All the books are covered. He writes articles about all this stuff all the time.
All right. Let's march to Mars, Sammy Hagar, right now as we finish up our first part. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be taking you back to an artist that was with us about a week or two ago, an indie filmmaker and Bleed American. That's all coming up. Stay with us.